Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Author Chat, hosted by Elizabeth Kelly. In each episode, we talk with writers about their recent works. What inspired them? What challenges did they face? And what impact will their work have on your life?
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Today, we are honored to have with us Adam Benferrato. Adam is an associate professor of law at Drexel University, and he is going to talk to us about his important and compelling new book titled Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Welcome, Adam.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And it's a pleasure to have you with us. You start Unfair with a very colorful anecdote, that is to say, a description of a trial by ordeal in 12th century France. Adam, tell our listeners, what was the trial by ordeal? And more importantly, why is that episode relevant in a book about 21st century criminal justice in America?
Well, people in medieval France actually had similar problems to the ones that we face currently. In particular, the question of how do you tell whether someone is guilty when you don't have an eyewitness or other hard evidence? And the way people living 900 years ago worked out things was to use a mechanism where they would throw someone in water, and if the person was expelled by the water, this pure water expelling someone who was impure, that was a sign that the person was guilty, and if they sunk, that was a sign that they were innocent. And in 12th century France, that made a lot of sense because it was believed that God controlled the natural elements, and that therefore this was a great way to tell whether someone deserved to be punished or not. And the reason that I start the book with this episode is to show us that something that can look very absurd 900 years in the future can make perfect sense to the people living in that time. And my fairly controversial or bold claim is that 900 years in the future, people are going to look back at our current criminal justice system and see something just as unfair, just as absurd as we see the system that existed in France 900 years ago.
And one of the goals of your book is to show how advances in psychology and neuroscience and science and medicine show not only the flaws in our system, but we can correct the flaws in our system. I want to go back, Adam, to something you said a few moments ago about the trial by ordeal. You said that that was a system that was often helpful when there weren't any eyewitnesses to an alleged crime. But as you point out in your book, we have witnesses to many crimes, and they did testify at trial. And still, sometimes, perhaps all too often, people are wrongfully convicted. Why does that happen?
Yeah, so that's one of the most interesting things, is that our legal system hasn't, in certain areas, hasn't really made very much progress since, you know, 12th century France. And one area is our faith in eyewitnesses. We still have incredible faith. We believe that we are able to tell whether someone does have a genuine memory or not. And when someone comes forward and says, yep, I'm 100% certain that that's the perpetrator, we can feel certain, we think, that we've got the right guy. But what the evidence suggests is that we make errors quite a lot. So in real lineups, a third of the time, a person picks out an innocent filler out of that lineup. That's despite the fact that tens of thousands of people in the United States are charged with crimes after being identified by an eyewitness each year. So how does this happen? Well, the answer is that our brain, or rather our memories, don't work the way that we suppose they work. A lot of us believe that they're basically like cameras. They take snapshots or video footage, which we then can recall, and that snapshot that we've taken, say, of the person robbing the bank is a genuine memory. It captures reality just as it is. And what we know is that our memories are incredibly malleable. They're very fragile. And so one of the things that I suggest in the book is that police officers need to treat them a lot more like they treat other trace evidence. So, you know, when there's a bloody handkerchief found at a crime scene, we take incredible care to preserve that piece of evidence, to carefully document how it's handled after it's been preserved. And we don't do the same thing with eyewitness memories, but we need to be a lot more cautious with how we handle eyewitnesses, starting from the very moment that they've observed a scene.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking with Adam Benferrato. Adam is an associate professor of law at Drexel University, where he teaches not only criminal law, but also an interesting course titled The Law and the Mind. Now, Adam, you cite a number of Northern European countries, namely Norway and Germany, about the progress they have made in the administration of criminal justice. Would tell us what some of those important advances are, and would it be possible, if you will, to export those advances to the United States?
So I think the area that they've been particularly successful is in the realm of corrections. In the United States, you know, we had an opportunity before the rise of the supermax prison and isolated confinement, you know, starting in the 1970s, we had an opportunity to create a society that looked a lot more like countries like Norway and the Netherlands and Germany. And we chose not to go down that path. We chose a path which I think is notable by how much it's influenced by this idea that criminals need to be paid back. It's all about retribution. And I think that's been a total failure. I think that our system has not delivered just deserts to the people we think deserve it most. If you look at the people who are in solitary confinement, many of the people suffer from horrible mental illness, which is directly linked to their criminal behavior and their troubles in prison. We know that you know, many of the people who are raped in prison happen to be people, nonviolent offenders, people who have been sexually abused previously. And so we deliver horrible suffering.
In addition to juveniles and people with intellectual disabilities.
Absolutely. And so this idea that we're paying people back, we're giving them their just desserts, is absolutely absurd, in my opinion. And the sad thing is our prisons don't make us safer, right? A lot of the people that we lock up in these atrocious conditions are eventually released back in society. And I think the thing that these Northern European countries have realized is that if you put people in monstrous conditions, you're going to create monsters. And, you know, that's all well and good if you keep those monsters locked up. But in the United States, the vast majority of people who are in these atrocious conditions are then let back into our community. So even if you are someone who has very little empathy for these individuals, it's, you know, just on a dollars and cents approach, it makes no sense. Now, I think we ought to feel great empathy for these individuals, and that's just an added reason, I think, to reform things. If you look at a country like Norway, they have a much smaller prison population. I think that's a starting point for us, is we don't need to lock up as many people as we do. I think we don't need to lock them up for as long. The research on deterrence suggests that these long, harsh prison sentences do very little in terms of deterrence. And I think we need to think a lot more about rehabilitation. If we want people to be successful who have already had problems in their lives, we don't need to give them less help and isolate them more. We need to give them more help so that they can be full citizens.
Well, one of the points that you make in your book is even after the prison sentence is over, the sentence really is not over. That is to say, someone is released from prison, sometimes with very, very little skills, and beyond that, that person faces a host of collateral consequences like restriction in housing, benefits. That person in many states loses the right to vote. That person effectively loses his or her right to fully participate as a citizen in our society and to reintegrate as a productive, law-abiding citizen.
Yes, and that seems so misguided to me. I think that really these Northern European countries really have this right, which is that we can't expect people to be successful when they come out of prison unless we give them the tools to be successful. So one of those things is access to social services and the tools of citizenship. That includes voting. That includes health benefits and things like that. On the other hand, I think that we need to ensure that they have jobs. One of the best predictors on whether someone is going to steer their life onto the straight and narrow is whether they have a job. Now, in the United States, we don't work towards that end. We leave people in a terrible situation. Part of that is the check-the-box rules, which mean that most people, to get a job, you've got to disclose that you've committed a crime and you're not going to get hired. You know, I think it's something like 4 out of 5 employers do background checks on people, and that is a strike against you. That cannot continue if we want people to integrate. And the final area I think we need to think about is with family connections. It makes no sense to me that when you commit a crime, all your ties to your family should be severed. For one thing, I think that really punishes the children and sets the children of people who are incarcerated up for failure later in life. So I think that needs to be changed. I think it also needs to be changed for the offender. I think when people maintain their family connections, bolster their family connections, those people are then invested in helping that person and making sure that that person does not end up back in prison. Other countries do a much better job on that front.
And one of the things that makes my blood boil is when someone is convicted in a particular jurisdiction or pleads guilty in a certain jurisdiction and then is transferred to a prison all the way across the country, probably in a very remote part of the country where visiting is impossible, not only because of distance, but also because of sheer accessibility.
Absolutely. And it just doesn't make sense. I mean, I think we need a new mindset. We're so focused on delivering payback that we lose sight of what we care most about, which is providing a safer society for everyone. I think a public health model, which focused on, well, how do we repair the damage which has been committed? How do we ensure that this person gets healthy and is not going to do this again? And how do we, more broadly, prevent similar actions in the future, as opposed to just being so obsessed about blame and, delivering hurt to the person who has, hurt society? That we've tried that. We've tried it for decades, and it's been a total failure, and I think we need a new approach.
Well, and as you point out in the book, payback is a misnomer to the extent that it costs millions and billions of dollars to incarcerate people. Adam, I want to end on a discussion of probably one of the most controversial points in your book. You have a very lengthy chapter of reforms that the criminal justice system should make. And one of the reforms you suggest is that of a virtual trial. Explain to our listeners what a virtual trial might be, why it would solve for a variety of ills, and then finally, indulge me, Adam. You know I'm a criminal defense lawyer. How do you get over the hurdle of the accused losing his or her right to confrontation if the trial is virtual?
Okay, so that great question. So the first thing I'd note is that this is, in the book, this is the most controversial. This is really looking 50, 100, 200 years in the future. The book is filled with lots of practical things we need to do right now. Now, what do I suggest about looking in the future? Why would this be necessary? Well, there are, in the book, many, many examples of biases that we're not aware of that have to do with using our eyes or ears to sum someone up very quickly. And so we take cues off of the color of someone's skin. We know that African Americans face a lot of racial bias in our system when it comes to bail, when it comes to conviction, when it comes to getting the death penalty. We know that the attractiveness of people plays a role in how cases come out. So we know more attractive witnesses are more likely to be believed. We also know that people take cues when they're determining whether someone is lying on the stand. They focus on things like eye contact or shaking hands, which do not predict whether someone is lying. And so my thought was, well, what if we created a virtual space where we could control for all of these different biasing factors? We already use virtual spaces in the business world. We're increasingly using it in medicine. It occurred to me that this would be a good way for us to control for a lot of problems that are already arising, and that it would have additional benefits. So, you know, any prosecutor will tell you one of the hard things about, bringing in, victims of sexual assaults is that they're afraid to be in the same room with their attackers. And I think this is a way to make everyone feel less intimidated and nervous. I think it would mean that actually, the jury would be less focused on, how the defendant appeared at any given moment. I mean, defendants, when they come in, they often don't know how to act, right? Should I look sad? Should I look happy? Well, jurors are always taking cues off of that stuff, and it's a bad way to predict whether someone is guilty. My thought is we can control for that. And my hope is that with a virtual environment, we can preserve all of the good stuff, all the stuff that our cases are meant to turn on, right? The facts and the law, and get rid of all that stuff that's not supposed to make an impact, the bombastic attorney, things like that. Now, you asked me the final question, which is, can we get around some constitutional prohibitions here? I think the answer is yes. I mean, I think we already are making exceptions for certain types of virtual testimony, and I think we can do that in the future within the confines of the Constitution. Now, it's possible that other people disagree, and if that's the case, I think we should think about revising the Confrontation Clause. I think the rights of the defendant not to be judged based on the color of his skin may be more important than the right to confront one's witnesses directly in person. Now, it doesn't mean taking away the right to confront. It's just taking away the right to confront them directly in person.
Well, I think I hear another book coming. Adam, it was wonderful talking with you. As your book notes, we are limited only by our imaginations in terms of reforming our criminal justice system. And as you also point out, the injustices which occur do not occur most of the time because people are mean-spirited, but simply our system is a construction by human beings, and that, thus by definition, it's bound to be flawed. We've been talking with Adam Benferrato. Adam is a professor at Drexel University School of Law, and he has written a provocative and important new book titled Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. I'm Elizabeth Kelly, and you've been listening to Author Chat.